From the KTOO newsroom in Juneau, I'm Yvonne Krumrie. You've seen the helicopters and the fancy ships downtown, but exactly how big is the Coast Guard's presence in Juneau? For this episode of Curious Juneau, KTOO tells us how these service members find themselves embedded in Juneau's community. There are about 150 Coast Guard members in Juneau altogether, and 270 throughout Southeast Alaska. That's the short answer. But because there isn't an official Coast Guard base in Juneau, like in Kodiak, their presence is spread out around town. And Lieutenant Catherine Cavender says they face the same challenges finding housing as the rest of the community.
I lived in a hotel for 4 months before I was able to move into my rental.
Cavender has served 1 year in town so far, with two more to go. One of her favorite parts of being stationed here is fishing.
I did catch a king salmon from the beach, which I'm very proud about.
That's awesome.
I think I've showed everybody my fish pic.
That's amazing. Wow.
It's a new hobby that she started here. She says Juneau is a nice place to be stationed.
People definitely come back here for their last tour or come back here and know that they want to retire here. I think it's really rare to see people retour so heavily in one spot.
She said the town can feel like home to a lot of service members who integrate more into the community than they would elsewhere. It's also the kind of place service members like to raise their families in. As of 2019, Coast Guard members had more than 400 dependents living in Juneau, too.
It's a major footprint.
Melani Shivens runs the local research firm Rain Coast Data.
And then we also have people who work for the Coast Guard who are not active duty. So it does end up being a significant economic driver in the community.
Both the statewide unit and the regional unit called Sector Juneau have their administrative offices in Juneau's federal building. There are officers who work for the local unit called Station Juneau as well. Damon Stubner works at the State Library. He made a documentary about the Coast Guard cutter Storis, which was based in Juneau in the 40s and 50s. He said that in the past, the Coast Guard's presence was a lot more visible.
If the ship had to leave for an emergency situation, the first officer of the ship, the executive officer, would call around to like the Imperial and the Red Dog and say, "Is my crew there? Get them out. We need to leave."
Stubner says the movie theater even used to have a red light that would start flashing to tell Coast Guardsmen to report for duty right away. The work was different then, too. Stubner said the Coast Guard also delivered mail, groceries, and supplies to coastal villages. In the past, the Coast Guard served in certain combat situations like Vietnam and Bahrain, but that's not what typical service looks like.
A different type of service thing.
Retired Captain Ed Page runs the Marine Exchange.
It's not just when there's a war, fight it. It's like, it doesn't matter. It's a war all the time. The war is in protecting the environment. The war is, saving lives when the vessels sink.
Joe Geldhoff, a maritime lawyer, said the Coast Guard rises to its many roles in Juneau.
It's kind of like a Swiss Army knife. It's got a lot of tools in it, some of which are very difficult, and they do extremely well.
And Sector Juneau has a huge area of responsibility. From Dixon Entrance to Icy Bay, Geldhoff says that between the size and the amount of work, it's a lot for one group to take on.
I would say the Coast Guard is a reflection of all the disparate activities that they require by law to undertake. Fisheries enforcement, drug interdiction. At some point, you might conclude, if you really study it, that they have too many tasks.
Chief Postmates, United States Coast Guard, arriving.
The Coast Guard recently held its change of command ceremony in Juneau. Senior Chief Bosun Mate Sean Crocker is on his way out. In the last 2 years, his unit conducted 90 search and rescue operations. He says he didn't want to come to Alaska when he was younger, but now he's going to miss it.
So it's a literal more fair than sweet. And it's not because I'm going to miss all the amazing, fishing and hunting, boating. For me, it's going to be the people.
He's passing the torch to Chief Bosun's mate, Nicholas Sudbury, who will now direct Station Juneau. And in Juneau, I'm Yvonne Krumrie. The U.S. Supreme Court issued a decision last week limiting the Environmental Protection Agency's authority over wetlands, and the implications for Alaska could be substantial. Alaska Public Media's Liz Ruskin has more.
Governor Mike Dunleavy applauded the ruling, saying it will help promote responsible development in Alaska. The case, called Sackett versus EPA, is about what constitutes waters of the United States, meaning how far inland and upland the Clean Water Act applies. One project that could be affected is the proposed Pebble Mine upstream from Bristol Bay. In January, the EPA used its veto authority under the Clean Water Act to block the project. Pebble CEO John Shively says the implications of the case aren't clear yet, but he says the ruling helps move the EPA's authority closer to what Congress intended. Until now, property owners have needed a federal permit, for instance, to fill a bog or stream, if there's a significant nexus between that bog or stream and a larger waterway that's considered navigable. With the Sackett decision, the court says the federal law applies only if there's a continuous surface connection between the area and a navigable waterway. Attorney Bridget Passarianos at the environmental law firm Trustees for Alaska predicts it will be a tough test to follow in Alaska.
I know we see that in Alaska a lot, right? We have these big braided rivers that tend to shift and move. There's many, many places that are suffering from a lot of erosion. The erosion is a huge problem, and so it's changing where a lot of these waterways are.
Pebble Mine opponent Alana Hurley, director of United Tribes of Bristol Bay, says the Sackett case isn't a threat to the EPA's determination blocking the mine, but Hurley calls it, quote, incredibly concerning, unquote, because it limits protections for critical wetlands, rivers, and lakes. In Anchorage, I'm Liz Ruskin.
Invasive green crabs are in Alaska, and they are destructive, outcompeting native species and destroying essential eelgrass. At a workshop in Metlakatla last month, citizen scientists learned from experts how to look out for the invasive crabs in their own communities. KRBD's Reagan Miller has more.
Scientists and concerned Alaskans are at Tamgis Harbor. They're getting a firsthand look at the European green crab, and time is of the essence. The crabs showed up in southern southeast Alaska last summer, and more than 800 have been found since.
It's like we hit the ground running coming out here.
Taylor Stumpf is with the Wildlife Department of Metlakatla's tribe. He's helping people learn to identify, measure, and document the crabs. The workshop drew participants from around the region, including Ketchikan, Cake, and Prince of Wales Island. For now, Metlakatla is the only place in Alaska to document live green crabs, which are destroying vital eelgrass and habitat for abalone, clams, and Dungeness crabs. But that doesn't mean they won't spread. That's why the workshop, which was organized by local, state, federal, and tribal agencies, focused on training people to identify the crabs and alert authorities before it's too late to control the spread. People aren't allowed to kill the crabs themselves, but they are encouraged to collect information and alert authorities. That's what the workshop is teaching them to do. Stumpf explains a few key tells for a crab that doesn't belong.
They have the five spines on either side of the eyes and then the three bumps in the middle. So we've been teaching people with guides how to identify the crabs.
Ewa Booth is showing people how to set and bait different kinds of traps. She's an intern with Metlakatla's Wildlife Department. She says the tribe has been experimenting with what works best.
They usually like chum and herring fish. We haven't really used cat food like they suggested.
Booth says she's noticed a difference on the beach since the first crab was found last year.
Eelgrass is important because it's like habitat for other clams and like juvenile fish, juvenile salmon. So it was kind of a worry for us when they first arrived, and I've noticed that they've gotten a lot shorter too, like the eelgrass.
There's no surefire way to eradicate the crabs once they've arrived, but Janelle Winter, Metlakatla's invasive species coordinator, says the key is to just keep finding them. She says Metlakatla has always protected its resources, and that's what the town will keep doing.
It just sharpened everybody's need or awareness to protect those resources, right? Like, those resources were already super precious. It's wanting to make sure they stay intact.
Each female crab is capable of laying hundreds of eggs. In Metlakatla, green crab catching is a full day's work. Just ask Gabriel Nathan.
Yeah, we've been catching a lot when they were molting, when they're trying to hatch eggs and everything, and we caught like over probably 40 green crab with eggs still attached to them. And that slowed down a lot, so it was great.
The workshop's message is also one of hope. If everyone learns to spot these crabs, maybe there's a way to protect other communities. Trey Patterson with Metlakatla's Wildlife Department says that's the goal.
I think that the state or other places near us were taking it as seriously as we were. It's great to see that more people are taking this issue seriously.
Patterson says everyone has a stake in stopping the crabs and that things will get even worse if the crabs keep moving north. Reporting in Ketchikan, I'm Reagan Miller.
You're listening to KTOO.